tried to swallow a few times. His mouth was dry as cotton. He got slowly to his knees. The agent was still alive, lying on his back, eyes open and still breathing. Ryan had to use his hand to stand up. He'd been hit twice, Ryan saw, once in the upper left chest and once lower down, about where the liver and spleen are. The lower wound was a wet red circle which the man's hands clutched. He was in his early 20s, if that, and his clear blue eyes were staring at the overhead while he tried to say something. His face was rigid with pain as he mouthed words, but all that came out was an unintelligible gurgle.
"Captain," Ryan called, "you okay?"
"I am wounded, but I think I shall live, Ryan."
"Who is it?"
"How the hell should I know?" The blue eyes fixed on Jack's face. Whoever he was, he knew death was coming for him. The pain on the face was replaced by something else. Sadness. An infinite sadness. He was still trying to speak. A pink froth gathered at the corners of his mouth. Lungshot. Ryan moved closer, kicking the gun clear and kneeling down beside him. "We could have made a deal," he said quietly. The agent tried to say something, but Ryan couldn't understand it. A curse, a call for his mother, something heroic? Jack would never know. The eyes went wide with pain one last time. The last breath hissed out through the bubbles, and the hands on the belly went limp. Ryan checked for a pulse at the neck. There was none. "I'm sorry." Ryan reached down to close the victim's eyes. He was sorry. Why? Tiny beads of sweat broke out all over his forehead, and the strength he had drawn upon in the shootout deserted him. A sudden wave of nausea overpowered him.
"Oh, Jesus, I'm—"
He dropped to all fours and threw up violently, his vomit spilling through the grates on the lower deck 10 feet below. For a whole minute, his stomach heaved, well past the time he was dry. He had to spit several times to get the worst of the taste from his mouth before standing. Dizzy from the stress and the quart of adrenaline that had been pumped into his system, he shook his head a few times, still looking at the dead man at his feet. It was time to come back to reality. Ramius had been hit in the upper leg. It was bleeding. Both his hands, covered with blood, were placed on the wound, but it didn't look that bad. If the femoral artery had been cut, the captain would have already been dead. Lieutenant Williams had been hit in the head and chest. He was still breathing, but unconscious. The head wound was only a crease. The chest wound, close to the heart, made a sucking noise. Kamarov was not so lucky. A single shot had gone straight through the top of his nose, and the back of his head was a bloody wreckage.
"Jesus, why didn't somebody come and help us?" Ryan said when the thought hit him.
"The bulkhead doors are closed, Ryan. There's the... how do you say it?"
Ryan looked where the captain pointed. It was the intercom system. "Which button?" The captain held up two fingers.
"Control room, this is Ryan. I need your help here. Your captain has been shot."
The reply came in excited Russian, and Ramius responded loudly to make himself heard. Ryan looked at the missile tube. The agent had been using a work light, just like an American one. A light bulb in a metal holder with wire across the front. A door into the missile tube was open. Beyond it, a smaller hatch, evidently leading into the missile itself, was also open.
What was he doing, trying to explode the warheads?
"Impossible," Ramius said in obvious pain. "The rocket warheads. We call this special safe. The warheads cannot... not fire."
So what was he doing?
Ryan went over to the missile tube. A sort of rubber bladder was lying on the deck. "What's this?" He hefted the gadget in his hand. It was made of rubber or rubberized fabric with a metal or plastic frame inside. A metal nipple on one corner and a mouthpiece.
"He was doing something to the missile, but he had an escape device to get off the sub," Ryan said. "Oh, Christ, a timing device."
He bent down to pick up the work light and switched it on, then stood back and peered into the missile compartment.
"Captain,
What's in here?
That is the guidance compartment. It has a computer that tells the rocket how to fly. The door,
Ramius's breaths were coming hard,
is a hatch for the officer.
Ryan peered into the hatch. He found a mass of multicolored wires and circuit boards connected in a way he'd never seen before. He poked through the wires, half expecting to find a ticking alarm clock wired to some dynamite sticks. He didn't. Now what should he do? The agent had been up to something, but what? Did he finish? How could Ryan tell? He couldn't. One part of his brain screamed at him to do something. The other part said that he'd be crazy to try. Ryan put the rubber-coated handle of the light between his teeth and reached into the compartment with both hands. He grabbed a double handful of wires and yanked back. Only a few broke loose. He released one bunch and concentrated on the other. A clump of plastic and copper spaghetti came loose. He did it again for the other bunch.
Ah!
He gasped, receiving an electric shock. An eternal moment followed while he waited to be blown up. It passed. There were more wires to pull. In under a minute, he'd ripped out every wire he could see along with a half dozen small breadboards. Next, he smashed the light against everything he thought might break until the compartment looked like his son's toy box, full of useless fragments. He heard people running into the compartment. Borodin was in front. Ramius motioned him over to Ryan and the dead agent.
Sudets,
Borodin said.
Sudets,
he looked at Ryan.
This is Cook.
Ryan took the pistol from the deck. Here's his recipe file. I think he was a GRU agent. He was trying to blow us up. Captain Ramius, how about we launch this missile? Just jettison the goddamn thing, okay?
A good idea, I think.
Ramius's voice had become a hoarse whisper.
First, close the inspection hatch. Then we can fire from the control room.
Ryan used his hand to sweep the fragments away from the missile hatch, and the door slid neatly back into place. The tube hatch was different. It was a pressure-bearing one, and much heavier, held in place by two spring-loaded latches. Ryan slammed it three times. Twice it rebounded, but the third time, it stuck. Borodin and another officer were already carrying Williams aft. Someone had set a belt on Ramius's leg wound. Ryan got him to his feet and helped him walk. Ramius grunted in pain every time he had to move his left leg.
You took a foolish chance, Captain, Ryan observed. This is my ship, and I do not like the dark. It was my fault. We should have made a careful counting as the crew left.
They arrived at the watertight door. Okay, I'll go through first. Ryan stepped through and helped Ramius through backwards. The belt had loosened, and the wound was bleeding again.
Close the hatch and lock it, Ramius ordered.
It closed easily. Ryan turned the wheel three times, then got under the captain's arm again. Another 20 feet, and they were in the control room. The lieutenant at the wheel was ashen. Ryan sat the captain in a chair on the port side.
You have a knife, sir?
Ramius reached in his trouser pocket and came out with a folding knife and something else.
Here, take this. It's the key for the rocket warheads. They cannot fire unless this is used.
You keep it.
He tried to laugh. It had been Putin's, after all. Ryan flipped it around his neck, opened the knife, and cut the captain's trousers all the way up. The bullet had gone clean through the meaty part of the thigh. He took a clean handkerchief from his pocket and held it against the entrance wound. Ramius handed him another handkerchief. Ryan placed this against the half-inch exit wound. Next, he set the belt across both, drawing it as tight as he could.
My wife might not approve, but that'll have to do.
Your wife?
Ramius asked.
She's a doc, an eye surgeon to be exact. The day I got shot, she did this for me.
Ramius's lower leg was growing pale. The belt was too tight, but Ryan didn't want to loosen it just yet.
Now, what about the missile?
Ramius gave an order to the lieutenant at the wheel, who relayed it through the intercom. 2 minutes later, three officers entered the control room. Speed was cut to 5 knots, which took several minutes. Ryan worried about the missile, and whether or not he had destroyed whatever booby trap the agent had installed. Each of the three newly arrived officers took a key from around his neck. Ramius did the same, giving his second key to Ryan. He pointed to the starboard side of the compartment.
Rocket control.
Ryan should have guessed as much. Arrayed throughout the control room were 5 panels, each with 3 rows of 26 lights and a key slot under each set.
Put your key in number 1, Ryan.
Jack did, and the others inserted their keys. The red light came on, and a buzzer sounded. The missile officer's panel was the most elaborate. He turned a switch to flood the missile tube and open the number 1 hatch. The red panel lights began to blink.
Turn your key, Ryan, Ramius said.
Does this fire the missile? Christ, what if that happens? Ryan wondered.
No, the rocket must be armed by the rocket officer. This key explodes the gas charge.
Could Ryan believe him? Sure, he was a good guy and all that, but how could Ryan know he was telling the truth?
Now, Ramius ordered.
Ryan turned his key at the same instant as the others. The amber light over the red light blinked on. The one under the green cover stayed off. The Red October shuddered as the number 1 SSN-20 was ejected upward by the gas charge. The sound was like a truck's air brake. The three officers withdrew their keys. Immediately, the missile officer shut the tube hatch. The Dallas.
What? Jones said. Con, sonar, the target just flooded a tube, a missile tube. God almighty!
On his own, Jones powered up the under-ice sonar and began high-frequency pinging.
What the hell are you doing? Thompson demanded.
Mancuso was there a second later.
What's going on? The captain snapped.
Jones pointed at his display.
The sub just launched a missile, sir. Look, Cap'n, 2 targets, but it's just hanging there. No missile ignition. God!
The Red October.
Will it float?
Ryan wondered. It didn't. The Seahawk missile was pushed upward and to starboard by the gas charge. It stopped 50 feet over her deck as the October cruised past. The guidance hatch that Ryan had closed was not fully sealed. Water filled the compartment and flooded the warhead bus. The missile, in any case, had a sizable negative buoyancy, and the added mass in the nose tipped it over. The nose-heavy trim gave it an eccentric path, and it spiraled down like a seed pod from a tree. At 10,000 feet, water pressure crushed the seal over the missile blast cones, but the Seahawk, otherwise undamaged, retained its shape all the way to the bottom. The Ethan Allen. The only thing still operating was the timer. It had been set for 30 minutes, which had allowed the crew plenty of time to board the Scamp, now leaving the area at 10 knots. The old reactor had been completely shut down. It was stone cold. Only a few emergency lights remained on from residual battery power. The timer had 3 redundant firing circuits, and all went off within a millisecond of one another, sending a signal down the detonator wires. They had put 4 Pave Pat Blue bombs on the Ethan Allen. The Pave Pat Blue was an FAE, fuel-air explosive, bomb. Its blast efficiency was roughly 5 times that of an ordinary chemical explosive. Each bomb had a pair of gas release valves, and only 1 of the 8 valves failed. When they burst open, the pressurized propane in the bomb casings expanded violently outwards. In an instant, the atmospheric pressure in the old submarine tripled as her every part was saturated with an explosive air-gas mixture. The 4 bombs filled the Ethan Allen with the equivalent of 25 tons of TNT, evenly distributed throughout the hull. The squibs fired almost simultaneously, and the results were catastrophic. The Ethan Allen's strong steel hull burst as if it were a balloon. The only item not totally destroyed was the reactor vessel, which fell free of the shredded wreckage and dropped rapidly to the ocean floor. The hull itself
was blasted into a dozen pieces, all bent into surreal shapes by the explosion. Interior equipment formed a metallic cloud within the shattered hull, and everything fluttered downwards, expanding over a wide area during the 3-mile descent to the hard sand bottom. The Dallas.
Holy shit!
Jones slapped the headphones off and yawned to clear his ears. Automatic relays within the sonar system protected his ears from the full force of the explosion, but what had been transmitted was enough to make him feel as though his head had been hammered flat. The explosion was heard through the hull by everyone aboard.
Attention, all hands, this is the captain speaking. What you just heard is nothing to worry about. That's all I can say.
God, Skipper, Mannion said.
Yeah, let's get back on the contact.
Aye, Captain.
Mannion gave his commander a curious look. The White House.
Did you get the word to him in time? The president asked.
No, sir. Moore slumped into his chair. The helicopter arrived a few minutes too late. It may be nothing to worry about. You'd expect that the captain would know enough to get everyone off except for his own people. We're concerned, of course, but there isn't anything we can do.
I asked him personally to do this, Judge.
Me.
Welcome to the real world, Mr. President, Moore thought. The chief executive had been lucky. He'd never had to send men to their deaths. Moore reflected that it was something easy to consider beforehand, less easy to get used to. He had affirmed death sentences from his seat on an appellate bench, and that had not been easy, even for men who had richly deserved their fates.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see, Mr. President. The source this data comes from is more important than any one operation.
Very well. What about Senator Donaldson?
He agreed to our suggestion. This aspect of the operation has worked out very well indeed.
Do you really expect the Russians to buy it? Pelt asked.
We've left some nice bait, and we'll jerk the line a little to get their attention. In a day or two, we'll see if they nibble at it. Henderson is one of their all-stars. His code name is Cassius, and the reaction to this will tell us just what sort of disinformation we can pass through him. He could turn out to be very useful, but we'll have to watch out for him. Our KGB colleagues have a very direct method for dealing with doubles.
We don't let him off the hook unless he earns it, the president said coldly.
Moore smiled.
Oh, he'll earn it. We own Mr. Henderson.
The 15th day. Friday, 17th December. Ocracoke Inlet. There was no moon. The three-ship procession entered the inlet at 5 knots, just after midnight, to take advantage of the extra-high spring tide. The Pogie led the formation, since she had the shallowest draft, and the Dallas trailed the Red October. The Coast Guard stations on either side of the inlet were occupied by naval officers who had relieved the coasties. Ryan had been allowed atop the sail, a humanitarian gesture from Ramius that he much appreciated. After 18 hours inside the Red October, Jack had felt confined, and it was good to see the world, even if it was nothing but dark empty space. The Pogie showed only a dim red light that disappeared if it was looked at for more than a few seconds. He could see the water's feathery wisps of foam and the stars playing hide-and-seek through the clouds. The west wind was a harsh 20 knots coming off the water. Borodin was giving terse, monosyllabic orders as he conned the submarine up a channel that had to be dredged every few months despite the enormous jetty which had been built to the north. The ride was an easy one. The 2 or 3 feet of chop was not mattering a whit to the missile sub's 30,000-ton bulk. Ryan was thankful for this. The black water calmed, and when they entered sheltered waters, a Zodiac-type rubber boat zoomed towards them.
Ahoy, Red October! A voice called in the darkness.
Ryan could barely make out the gray lozenge shape of the Zodiac. It was ahead of a tiny patch of foam formed by the sputtering outboard motor.
May I answer, Captain Borodin? Ryan asked, getting a nod. This is Ryan.
We have two casualties aboard. One's in bad shape. We need a doctor and a surgical team right away. Do you understand?
Two casualties and you need a doc, right? Ryan thought he saw a man holding something to his face, and thought he heard the faint crackle of a radio. It was hard to tell in the wind.
Okay, we'll have a doc flown down right away, October. Dallas and Pogey both have medical corpsmen aboard. You want 'em?
Damn straight, Ryan replied at once.
Okay, follow Pogey 2 more miles and stand by.
The Zodiac sped forward, reversed course, and disappeared in the darkness.
Thank God for that, Ryan breathed.
You are believer? Borodin asked.
Yeah, sure. Ryan should not have been surprised by the question.
Hell, you gotta believe in something.
And why is that, Commander Ryan?
Borodin was examining the Pogey through oversized night glasses.
Ryan wondered how to answer.
Well, because if you don't, what's the point of life?
That would mean Sartre and Camus and all those characters were right. All is chaos. Life has no meaning.
I refuse to believe that.
If you want a better answer, I know a couple of priests who'd be glad to talk to you.
Borodin did not respond. He spoke an order into the bridge microphone, and they altered course a few degrees to starboard. The Dallas. A half mile aft, Mancuso was holding a light-amplifying night scope to his eyes. Mannion was at his shoulder, struggling to see.
Jesus Christ, Mancuso whispered.
You got that one right, Skipper, Mannion said, shivering in his jacket. I'm not sure I believe it either. Here comes the Zodiac.
Mannion handed his commander the portable radio used for docking.
Do you read?
This is Mancuso.
When our friend stops, I want you to transfer 10 men to her, including your orderly. They report 2 casualties who need medical attention. Pick good men, Commander. They'll need help running the boat. Just make damn sure they're men who don't talk.
Acknowledged. 10 men, including the medic. Out.
Mancuso watched the raft speed off to the Pogey.
Want to come along, Pat?
Bet your ass, sir. You planning to go?
Mannion asked.
Mancuso was judicious.
I think Chambers is up to handling Dallas for a day or so, don't you?
On shore, a naval officer was on the phone to Norfolk. The Coast Guard station was crowded, almost entirely with officers. A fiberglass box sat next to the phone so that they could communicate with Sinkland in secrecy. They had been here only 2 hours and would soon leave. Nothing could appear out of the ordinary. Outside, an admiral and a pair of captains watched the dark shapes through starlight scopes. They were solemn as men in a church.
Cherry Point, North Carolina. Commander Ed Noyes was resting in the doctor's lounge of the Naval Hospital at the U.S. Marine Corps Air Station, Cherry Point, North Carolina. A qualified flight surgeon, he had the duty for the next 3 nights so that he'd have 4 days off over Christmas. It had been a quiet night. This was about to change.
Doc?
Noyes looked up to see a Marine captain in MP livery. The doctor knew him. Military police delivered a lot of accident cases. He set down his New England Journal of Medicine.
Hi, Jerry. Something come in?
Doc, I got orders to tell you to pack everything you need for emergency surgery. You got 2 minutes. Then I take you to the airfield.
What for? What kind of surgery?
Noyes stood.
They didn't say, sir, just that you fly out somewhere alone. The orders come from topside, that's all I know.
Damn it, Jerry, I have to know what sort of surgery it is, so I know what to take.
So take everything, sir. I gotta get you to the chopper.
Noyes swore and went into the trauma receiving room. 2 more Marines were waiting there. He handed them 4 sterile sets, prepackaged instrument trays. He wondered if he'd need some drugs and decided to grab an armful, along with 2 units of plasma. The captain helped him on with his coat, and they moved out the door to a waiting jeep. 5 minutes later, they pulled up to a Sea Stallion whose engines were already screaming.
What gives?
Noyes asked the colonel of intelligence inside, wondering where the crew chief was.
We're heading out over the sound, the colonel explained.
We have to let you down on a sub that has some casualties aboard. There's a pair of orderlies to assist you, and that's all I know, okay?
It had to be okay. There was no choice in the matter.
The stallion lifted off at once. Noyes had flown in them often enough. He had 200 hours piloting helicopters, another 300 in fixed-wing aircraft. Noyes was the kind of doctor who discovered too late that flying was as attractive a calling as medicine. He went up at every opportunity, often giving pilots special medical care for their dependents to get backseat time in an F-4 Phantom. The Sea Stallion, he noted, was not cruising. It was running flat out. Pamlico Sound. The Pogie came to a halt about the time the helicopter left Cherry Point. The October altered course to starboard again, and halted even with her to the north. The Dallas followed suit. A minute after that, the Zodiac reappeared at the Dallas's side, then approached the Red October slowly, almost wallowing with her cargo of men.
"Ahoy, Red October!"
This time, Borodin answered. He had an accent, but his English was understandable.
"Identify!"
"This is Bart Mancuso, commanding officer of USS Dallas. I have our ship's medical representative aboard and some other men. Request permission to come aboard, sir."
Ryan saw the star palm grimace. For the first time, Borodin really had to face up to what was happening, and he would have been less than human to accept it without some kind of struggle.
"Permission is... yes."
The Zodiac edged right up to the curve of the hull. A man leaped aboard with a line to secure the raft. 10 men clambered off, one breaking away to climb up the submarine's sail.
"Captain, I'm Bart Mancuso. I understand you have some hurt men aboard."
"Yes," Borodin nodded. "The captain and a British officer, both shot."
"Shot?" Mancuso was surprised. "Worry about that later," Ryan said sharply. "Let's get your doc working on them, okay?"
"Sure. Where's the hatch?"
Borodin spoke into the bridge mic, and a few seconds later, a circle of light appeared on deck at the foot of the sail.
"We haven't got a physician. We have an independent duty orderly. He's pretty good, and Pogie's man will be here in another couple minutes. Who are you, by the way?"
"He is a spy," Borodin said with palpable irony.
"Jack Ryan." "And you, sir?"
"Captain, second rank, Vasily Borodin. I am the first officer, yes? Come over into the station, Commander. Please excuse me, we are all very tired."
"You're not the only ones."
There wasn't that much room. Mancuso perched himself on the combing. "Captain, I want you to know that we had a bastard of a time tracking you. You are to be complimented for your professional skill." The compliment did not elicit the anticipated response from Borodin.
"You were able to track us? How?"
"I brought him along. You can meet him."
"And what are we to do?"
"Orders from shore are to wait for the doc to arrive and dive. Then we sit tight until we get orders to move. Maybe a day, maybe two. I think we could all use the rest. After that, we get you to a nice safe place, and I will personally buy you the best damn Italian dinner you ever had."
Mancuso grinned.
"You get Italian food in Russia?"
"No. And if you are accustomed to good food, you may find Krasny Oktyabr not to your liking."
"Maybe I can fix that. How many men aboard?"
12. 10 Soviet, the Englishman, and the spy."
Borodin glanced at Ryan with a thin smile.
"Okay."
Mancuso reached into his coat and came out with a radio.
"This is Mancuso."
"We're here, Skipper," Chambers replied. "Get some food together for our friends. 6 meals for 25 men. Send a cook over with it. Wally, I want to show these men some good chow. Got it?"
"Aye, aye, Skipper. Out."
"I got some good cooks, Captain. Shame this wasn't last week. We had lasagna, just like Mama used to make. All that was missing was the Chianti."
"They have vodka," Ryan observed.
"Only for spies," Borodin said.
2 hours after the shootout, Ryan had had the shakes badly, and Borodin had sent him a drink from the medical stores.
"We are told that..."
that your submarine men are greatly pampered.
Maybe so, Mancuso nodded. But we stay out 60 or 70 days at a time. That's hard enough, don't you think?
How about we go below, Ryan suggested. Everyone agreed. It was getting cold.
Borodin, Ryan, and Mancuso went below to find the Americans on one side of the control room and the Soviets on the other, just like before. The American captain broke the ice.
Captain Borodin, this is the man who found you. Come here, Jonesy.
It wasn't very easy, sir, Jones said. Can I get to work? Can I see your sonar room?
Bugayev.
Borodin waved the ship's electronics officer over. The captain-lieutenant led the sonar men aft. Jones took one look at the equipment and muttered,
Kludge.
The faceplates all had louvers on them to let out the heat.
God, did they use vacuum tubes?
Jones wondered. He pulled a screwdriver from his pocket to find out.
You speak English, sir?
Yes, a little.
Can I see the circuit diagrams for these, please?
Bugayev blinked. No enlisted men, and only one of his Mishmani had ever asked for it. Then he took the binder of schematics from its shelf on the forward bulkhead. Jones matched the code number of the set he was checking with the right section of the binder. Unfolding the diagram, he noted with relief that ohms were ohms all over the world. He began tracing his finger along the page, then pulled the cover panel off to look inside the set.
Kludge. Mega kludge to the max.
Jones was shocked enough to lapse into Valspeak.
Excuse me, what is this kludge?
Oh, pardon me, sir. That's an expression we use in the Navy. I don't know how to say it in Russian. Sorry.
Jones stifled a grin as he went back to the schematic.
Sir, this one here's a low-powered, high-frequency set, right? You use this one for mines and stuff?
It was Bugayev's turn to be shocked.
You have been trained in Soviet equipment?
No, sir, but I've heard a lot of it.
Wasn't this obvious? Jones wondered.
Sir, this is a high-frequency set, but it doesn't draw a lot of power. What else is it good for? A low-power FM set you use for mines, for work under ice, and for docking, right?
Correct.
You have a Gertrude, sir.
Gertrude?
Underwater telephone, sir, for talking to other subs.
Didn't this guy know anything?
Ah, yes, but it is located in control, and it is broken.
Uh-huh. Jones looked over the diagram again. I think I can rig a modulator on this baby, then, and make it into a Gertrude for you. Might be useful. You think your skipper would want that, sir?
I will ask.
He expected Jones to stay put, but the young sonar man was right behind him when he went to control. Bugayev explained the suggestion to Borodin while Jones talked to Mancuso.
They got a little FM set that looks just like the old Gertrudes in sonar school. We have a spare modulator in stores, and I can probably rig it up in 30 minutes, no sweat, the sonar man said.
Captain Borodin, do you agree? Mancuso asked.
Borodin felt as if he were being pushed too fast, even though the suggestion made perfectly good sense.
Yes. Have your men do it.
Skipper, how long are we going to be here? Jones asked.
A day or two. Why?
Sir, this boat looks kind of thin on creature comforts, you know? How about I grab a TV and a tape machine? Give them something to look at, you know? Sort of give them a quick look at the USA.
Mancuso laughed. They wanted to learn everything they could about this boat, but they had plenty of time for that, and Jones's idea looked like a good way to ease the tension. On the other hand, he didn't want to incite a mutiny on his own sub.
Okay. Take the one from the wardroom.
Right, Skipper.
The Zodiac delivered the Pogie's orderly a few minutes later, and Jones took the boat back to the Dallas. Gradually, the officers were beginning to engage in conversation. Two Russians were trying to talk to Mannion and were looking at his hair. They had never met a black man before.
Captain Borodin, I have orders to take something out of the control room that will identify, I mean, something that comes from this boat.
Mancuso pointed.
Can I take that depth gauge? I can have one of my men rig a substitute.
The gauge, he saw, had a number.
For what reason?
Beats me, but those are my orders.
Yes,
Borodin replied. Mancuso ordered one of his chiefs to perform the job. The chief pulled a crescent wrench from his pocket and removed the nut holding the needle and dial in place.
This is a little bigger than ours, Skipper, but not by much. I think we have a spare. I can flip it backwards and scribe in the markings, okay?
Mancuso handed his radio over. Call it in, and have Jonesy bring the spare back with him.
Aye, Captain.
The chief put the needle back in place after setting the dial on the deck. The Sea Stallion did not attempt to land, though the pilot was tempted. The deck was almost large enough to try. As it was, the helicopter hovered a few feet over the missile deck, and the doctor leaped into the arms of two seamen. His supplies were tossed down a moment later. The colonel remained in the back of the chopper and slid the door shut. The bird turned slowly to move back southwest, its massive rotor raising spray from the waters of Pamlico Sound.
Was that what I think it was? The pilot asked over the intercom.
Wasn't it backwards? I thought missile subs had the missiles after the sail. Those were in front of the sail, weren't they? I mean, wasn't that the rudder sticking up behind the sail? The co-pilot responded quizzically.
It was a Russian sub, the pilot said.
What? It was too late to see. They were already 2 miles away.
Those were our guys on the deck. They weren't Russians.
Son of a bitch, the major swore wonderingly, and he couldn't say a thing. The colonel of Division Intelligence had been damn specific about that.
You don't see nothing, you don't hear nothing, you don't think nothing, and you goddamn well don't ever say nothing.
I'm Dr. Noyes, the commander said to Mancuso in the control room. He had never been on a submarine before, and when he looked around, he saw a compartment full of instruments, all in a foreign language.
What ship is this?
Kresny Oktyabr, Borodin said, coming over. In the centerpiece of his cap, there was a gleaming red star.
What the hell is going on here? Noyes demanded.
Doc, Ryan took him by the arm, you have two patients aft. Why not let's worry about them?
Noyes followed him aft to sickbay.
What's going on here? He persisted more quietly.
The Russians just lost a submarine, Ryan explained, and now she belongs to us. And if you tell anybody...
I read you, but I don't believe you.
You don't have to believe me.
What kind of cutter are you?
Thoracic.
Good. Ryan turned into sickbay. You have a gunshot wound victim who needs you bad.
Williams was lying naked on the table. A sailor came in with an armful of medical supplies and set them on Petrov's desk. The October's medical locker had a supply of frozen plasma, and the two orderlies already had two units running into the lieutenant. A chest tube was in, draining into a vacuum bottle.
We got a 9mm in this man's chest, one of the corpsmen said, after introducing himself and his partner. He's had a chest tube in the last 10 hours, they tell me. The head looks worse than it is. Right pupil is a little brown, but no big deal. The chest is bad, sir. You better take a listen.
Vitals?
Noyes fished in his bag for a stethoscope.
Heart is 110 and thready. Blood pressure's 80/40.
Noyes moved his stethoscope around William's chest, frowning.
Heart's in the wrong place.
We had a left-tension pneumothorax. There must be a quart of fluid in there, and it sounds like he's heading for congestive failure.
Noyes turned to Ryan.
You, get out of here. I got a chest to crack.
Take care of him, Doc. He's a good man.
Aren't they all? Noyes observed, stripping off his jacket.
Let's get scrubbed, people.
Ryan wondered if a prayer would help. Noyes looked and talked like a surgeon. Ryan hoped he was. He went aft to the captain's cabin, where Ramius was sleeping with the drugs he'd been given. The leg had stopped bleeding, and evidently one of the orderlies had checked on it. Noyes could work on him next. Ryan went forward.
Borodin felt that he had lost control and didn't like it, though it was something of a relief.
2 weeks of constant tension, plus the nerve-wrenching change in plans, had shaken the officer more than he would have believed. The situation was now unpleasant. The Americans were trying to be kind, but they were so damned overpowering. At least the Red October's officers were not in danger. 20 minutes later,
the Zodiac was back again. Two sailors went topside to unload a few hundred pounds of frozen food, then helped Jones with his electronic gear. It took several minutes to get everything squared away, and the seaman who took the food forward came back shaken after finding two stiff bodies and a third frozen solid. There had not been time to move the two recent casualties.
"Got everything, Skipper," Jones reported. He handed the depth gauge dial to the chief.
"What is all of this?" Borodine asked.
"Captain, I got the modulator to make the Gertrude." Jones held up a small box. "This other stuff is a little color TV, a video cassette recorder, and some movie tapes. The skipper thought you gentlemen might want something to relax with, to get to know us a little, you know?"
"Movies?"
Borodine shook his head.
"Cinema movies?"
"Sure," Mancuso chuckled. "What'd you bring, Jonesy?"
"Well, sir, I got E.T., Star Wars, Big Jake, and Hondo."
Clearly Jones wanted to be careful what parts of America he introduced the Russians to.
"My apologies, Captain. My crewman has limited taste in movies."
At the moment, Borodine would have settled for the battleship Potemkin. The fatigue was really hitting him hard. The cook bustled aft with an armload of groceries.
"I'll have coffee in a few minutes, sir," he said to Borodine on his way to the galley.
"I would like something to eat. None of us has eaten in a day," Borodine said.
"Food!" Mancuso called aft.
"Aye, skipper, let me figure this galley out."
Mannion checked his watch.
20 minutes, sir."
"We've everything we need aboard?"
"Yes, sir."
Jones bypassed the pulse control on the sonar amplifier and wired in the modulator. It was easier than he'd expected. He had taken a radio microphone from the Dallas along with everything else and now connected it to the sonar set before powering the system up. He had to wait for the set to warm up. Jones hadn't seen this many tubes since he'd gone out on TV repair jobs with his father, and that had been a long time ago.
"Dallas, this is Jonesy. Do you copy?"
"Aye."
The reply was scratchy, like a taxicab radio.
"Thanks. Out."
He switched it off.
"It works. That was pretty easy, wasn't it?"
"Enlisted man. Hell. And not even trained on Soviet equipment,"
the October's electronics officer thought. It never occurred to him that this piece of equipment was a near copy of an obsolete American FM system.
"How long have you been a sonar man?"
3.5 years, sir, since I dropped out of college."
"You'll learn all of this in 3 years?"
the officer asked sharply.
Jones shrugged.
"What's the big deal, sir? I've been fooling with radios and stuff since I was a kid. You mind if I play some music, sir?" Jones had decided to be especially nice. He had only one tape of a Russian composer, the Nutcracker Suite, and had brought that along with 4 boxes. Jones liked to hear music while he prayed over circuit diagrams. The young sonar man was in hog heaven. All the Russian sets he had listened to for 3 years, now he had their schematics, their hardware, and the time to figure them all out. Bugayev continued to watch in amazement as Jones's fingers did their ballet through the manual pages to the music of Tchaikovsky.
"Time to dive, sir," Mannion said in control.
"Very well. With your permission, Captain Borodine, I will assist with the vents. All hatches and openings are... shut. The diving board used the same light array system as American boats," Mancuso noticed. Mancuso took stock of the situation one last time. Butler and his 4 most senior petty officers were already tending to the nuclear tea kettle aft. The situation looked pretty good, considering. The only thing that could really go badly wrong would be for the October's officers to change their minds. The Dallas would be keeping the missile sub under constant sonar observation. If she moved, the Dallas had a 10-knot speed advantage with which to block the channel.
"The way I see it, Captain, we are rigged for dive," Mancuso said.
Borodine nodded and sounded the diving alarm. It was a buzzer, just like on American boats. Mancuso, Mannion, and a Russian officer worked the complex vent controls. The Red October began her slow descent. In 5 minutes, she was resting on the bottom, with 70 feet of water over the top of her sail. The White House. Pelt was on the phone to the Soviet embassy at 3 in the morning.
Alex, this is Jeffrey Pelt.
How are you, Dr. Pelt? I must offer my thanks and that of the Soviet people for your action to save our sailor. I was informed a few minutes ago that he is now conscious and that he is expected to recover fully.
Yes, I just learned that myself. What's his name, by the way?
Pelt wondered if he had awakened Arbatov.
It didn't sound like it.
Andrei Katiskin, a Cook Betty officer from Leningrad.
Good. Alex, I am informed that USS Pigeon has rescued nearly the entire crew of another Soviet submarine off the Carolinas. Her name, evidently, was Red October. That's the good news, Alex. The bad news is that the vessel exploded and sank before we could get them all off. Most of the officers, and two of our officers, were lost.
When was this?
Very early yesterday morning. Sorry about the delay, but Pigeon had trouble with the radio as a result of the underwater explosion, they say. You know how that sort of thing can happen.
Indeed.
Pelt had to admire the response. Not a trace of irony.
Where are they now?
The Pigeon is sailing to Charleston, South Carolina. We'll have your crewmen flown directly to Washington from there.
And this submarine exploded, you are sure?
Yeah, one of the crewmen said they had a major reactor accident. It was just good luck that Pigeon was there. She was heading to the Virginia coast to look at the other one you lost.
I think your Navy needs a little work, Alex,
Pelt observed.
I will pass that along to Moscow, Doctor,
Arbatov responded dryly.
Can you tell us where this happened?
I can do better than that. We have a ship taking a deep diving research sub down to look for the wreckage. If you want, you can have your Navy fly a man to Norfolk, and we'll fly him out to check it for you.
Fair enough? You say you lost two officers.
Arbatov played for time, surprised at the offer.
Yes, both rescue people.
We did get 100 men off, Alex, Pelt said defensively.
That's something.
Indeed it is, Dr. Pelt. I must cable Moscow for instructions. I will be back to you.
You are at your office.
Correct.
Bye, Alex.
He hung up and looked at the president.
Do I pass, boss?
Work a little bit on the sincerity, Jeff. The president was sprawled in a leather chair, a robe over his pajamas.
They'll bite?
They'll bite. They sure as hell want to confirm the destruction of the sub. Question is, can we fool them?
Foster seems to think so. It sounds plausible enough.
Well, we have her, don't we?
Pelt observed.
Yep. I guess that story about the GRU agent was wrong, or else they kicked him off with everybody else. I want to see that Captain Ramius. Jeez, pulling a reactor scare. No wonder he got everybody off the ship.
The Pentagon. Skip Tyler was in the CNO's office trying to relax in a chair. The Coast Guard station on the inlet had a low-light television, the tape from which had been flown by helicopter to Cherry Point, and from there, by Phantom jet fighter, to Andrews. Now it was in the hands of a courier whose automobile was just pulling up at the Pentagon's main entrance.
I have a package to hand deliver to Admiral Foster, an ensign announced a few minutes later.
Foster's flag secretary pointed him to the door.
Good morning, sir. This is for you.
The ensign handed Foster the wrapped cassette.
Thank you. Dismissed.
Foster inserted the cassette into the tape player atop his office television. The set was already on, and the picture appeared in several seconds. Tyler was standing beside the CNO as it focused.
Yep. Yep, Foster agreed.
The picture was lousy. No other words for it. The low-light television system did not give a very sharp picture, since it amplified all of the ambient light equally. This tended to wash out many details. But what they saw was enough. A very large missile submarine whose sail was much further aft than the sails on anything a Western country made. She dwarfed the Dallas and the Pogey. They watched the screen without a word for the next 15 minutes. Except for the wobbly camera, the picture was about as lively as a test pattern.
Well, Foster said as the tape ended, we got us a Russian boomer.
How about that? Tyler grinned. Skip, you were up for command of Los Angeles, right?
Yes, sir.
We owe you for this, Commander. We owe you a lot. I did some checking the other day. An officer injured in the line of duty does not necessarily have to retire unless he is demonstrably unfit for duty. An accident while returning from work on your boat is line of duty, I think, and we've had a few ship commanders who were short a leg. I'll go to the president myself on this, son. It will mean a year's work getting back in the groove, but if you still want your command, by God, I'll get it for you. Tyler sat down for that. It would mean being fitted for a new leg, something he'd been considering for months, and a few weeks getting used to it. Then a year, a good year, relearning everything he needed to know before he could go to sea. He shook his head. Thank you, Admiral. You don't know what that means to me. But no. I'm past that now. I have a different life, and different responsibilities now, and I'd just be taking someone else's slot. Tell you what, you let me get a look at that boomer, and we're even.
That I can guarantee.
Foster had hoped he'd respond that way, had been nearly sure of it. It was too bad, though. Tyler, he thought, would have been a good candidate for his own flag, except for the leg. Well, nobody ever said the world was fair.
The Red October.
You guys seem to have things under control, Ryan observed. Does anybody mind if I flake out somewhere?
Flake out? Borodin asked.
Sleep.
Ah, take Dr. Petrov's cabin, across from the medical office.
On his way aft, Ryan looked in Borodin's cabin and found the vodka bottle that had been liberated. It didn't have much taste, but it was smooth enough. Petrov's bunk was not very wide or very soft. Ryan was past caring. He took a long swallow and lay down in his uniform, which was already so greasy and dirty as to be beyond hope. He was asleep in 5 minutes.
The sea cliff.
The air purifier system was not working properly, Lieutenant Sven Johnson thought. If his sinus cold had lasted a few more days, he might not have noticed. The sea cliff was just passing 10,000 feet, and they couldn't tinker with the system until they surfaced. It was not dangerous. The environmental control systems had as many built-in redundancies as the space shuttle. Just a nuisance.
I've never been so deep, Captain Igor Kaganovich said, conversationally.
Getting him here had been complicated. It had required a Helix helicopter from the Kiev to the Tarawa, then a U.S. Navy Sea King to Norfolk. Another helicopter had taken him to the USS Austin, which was heading for 33 North, 75 West, at 20 knots. The Austin was a landing ship dock, a large vessel whose aft end was a covered well. She was usually used for landing craft, but today she carried the Sea Cliff, a three-man submarine that had been flown down from Woods Hole, Massachusetts.
Does take some getting used to, Johnson agreed, but when you get down to it, 500 feet, 10,000 feet, doesn't make much difference. A hull fracture would kill you just as fast. Just down here, there'd be less residue for the next boat to try and recover.
Keep thinking those happy thoughts, sir. Machinist mate, First Class Jesse Overton said. Still clear on sonar?
Right, Jess.
Johnson had been working with the machinist mate for 2 years. The Sea Cliff was their baby, a small, rugged research submarine, mainly used for oceanographic tasks, including the emplacement or repair of SOSU's sensors. On the three-man sub, there was little place for bridge discipline. Overton was not well-educated or very articulate, at least not politely articulate. His skill at maneuvering the mini-sub was unsurpassed, however, and Johnson was just as happy to leave that job to him. It was the lieutenant's task to manage the mission at hand.
Air system needs some work, Johnson observed.
Yeah, the filters are about due for replacement. I was going to do that next week. Could have done it this morning, but I figured the backup control wiring was more important.
Guess I'll have to go along with you on that. Handling okay?
Like a virgin.
Overton's smile was reflected in the thick Lexan viewport in front of the control seat. The Sea Cliff's awkward design made her clumsy to maneuver. It was as though she knew what she wanted to do,
just not quite how she wanted to do it.
How wide's the target area?
Pretty wide.
Pigeon says after the explosion, the pieces spread from hell to breakfast.
I believe it. 3 miles down and a current to spread it around.
The boat's name is Red October, Captain? A Victor-class attack submarine, you said?
That is your name for the class, Kaganovich said.
What do you call them? Johnson asked.
He got no reply.
What was the big deal, he wondered.
What did the name of the class matter to anybody?
Switching on locator sonar, Johnson activated several systems, and the sea cliff pulsed with the sound of the high-frequency sonar mounted on her belly.
There's the bottom.
The yellow screen showed bottom contours in white.
Anything sticking up, sir? Overton asked.
Not today, Jess.
A year before, they had been operating a few miles from this spot and had nearly been impaled on a Liberty ship sunk around 1942 by a German U-boat. The hulk had been sitting up at an angle, propped up by a massive boulder. That near collision would surely have been fatal, and it had taught both men caution.
Okay, I'm starting to get some hard returns. Directly ahead, spread out like a fan, another 500 feet to the bottom.
Right.
There's one big piece. About 30 feet long, maybe 9 or 10 across, 11 o'clock, 300 yards. We'll go for that one first.
Coming left. Lights coming on now.
A half dozen high-intensity floodlights came on, at once surrounding the submersible in a globe of light. It did not penetrate more than 10 yards in the water, which ate up the light's energy.
There's the bottom, just where you said, Mr. Johnson, Overton said.
He halted the powered descent and checked for buoyancy. Almost exactly neutral. Good.
This current's going to be tough on battery power.
How strong is it?
Knot and a half, maybe more like 2, depending on bottom contours. Same as last year. I figure we can maneuver an hour, hour and a half tops.
Johnson agreed. Oceanographers were still puzzling over this deep current, which seemed to change direction from time to time, in no particular pattern.
Odd.
There were a lot of odd things in the ocean. That's why Johnson got his oceanography degree, to figure some of the buggers out. It sure beat working for a living. Being 3 miles down wasn't work. Not to Johnson.
I see something. A flash off the bottom right in front of us. Want me to grab it?
If you can.
They couldn't see it yet on any of the sea cliff's 3 TV monitors, which looked straight ahead, 45 degrees left and right of the bow.
Okay. Overton put his right hand on the Waldo control. This was what he was really best at.
Can you see what it is? Johnson asked, fiddling with the TV.
Some kind of instrument. Can you kill the number one flood, sir? It's dazzling me.
Wait one.
Johnson leaned forwards to kill the proper switch. The number one floodlight provided illumination for the bow camera, which went immediately blank.
Okay, baby, now let's just hold steady.
The machinist's mate's left hand worked the directional propeller controls. His right was poised in the Waldo glove. Now, he was the only one who could see the target. Overton's reflection was grinning at itself. His right hand moved rapidly.
Gotcha, he said.
The Waldo took the depth gauge dial a diver had magnetically affixed to the sea cliff's bow prior to setting out from the Austin's dock bay.
You can hit the light again, sir.
Johnson flicked it on, and Overton maneuvered his catch in front of the bow camera.
Can you see what it is?
Looks like a depth gauge. Not one of ours, though, Johnson observed. Can you make it out, Captain?
Da,
Kaganovich said at once. He let out a long breath, trying to sound unhappy.
It is one of ours. I cannot read the number, but it is Soviet.
Put it in the basket, Jess, Johnson said.
Right.
He maneuvered the Waldo, placing the dial in a basket welded on the bow, then getting the manipulator arm back to its rest position.
Getting some silt. Let's pick up a little.
As the sea cliff got too close to the bottom, the wash from her propellers stirred up the fine alluvial silt. Overton increased power to get back to a 20-foot height.
That's better.
See what the current is doing, Mr. Johnson? Good 2 knots. Gonna cut our bottom time.
The current was wafting.